The orchestration of religious life in America today is ecumenical. Churchmen are busy rediscovering the ties that bind. The unchurched are eager for an end to a long and lingering period of bitterness and distance. Twice blessed, therefore, the man who today can find and teach of the truth in another man's teaching. It is against this background of determined amiability that I should like to discuss with you this morning the second of the Ten Commandments. The text is well known. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any manner of likeness of anything that is in the heavens above, or the earth beneath, or the waters under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a zealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers unto the second and third generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto the thousandth generation of them that love me and keep my commandments. The second commandment casts a parochial shadow. Says quite clearly that there is a limit to ecumenicity, that there is a worship which is proper, and there is a worship which is improper and necessarily proscribed. Now, the second commandment was spoken to our fathers in a generation, in an age not unlike our own. The pagan world was religiously syncretistic. Men were quite flexible about their gods, quite prepared to add another god or another god still to their pantheon, quite prepared to worship and visit this shrine or another. The doctrine of denominational relativism was part of the pagan way of life. The second commandment was by way of being a cold blast of air, pushing the Hebrew away from the heathen melting pot. A chilling reminder that the Jew could not adopt for himself and welcome rationalization that there is some truth in all teaching, that there is some virtue in every worship. The second commandment forces us, I believe, to ask these questions. Does it really matter where we worship? Are all the modern faiths equally valid? Is it simply enough to believe? Or must we be concerned with the content and the substance of belief? The orchestration of religious life today in America is ecumenical. And it's as best this melody had made it possible for men of varying affirmations and persuasions, men of goodwill, to unite in common concern against the enemies of endemic poverty and ruthless violence, obdurate ignorance, and obstinate injustice. The mingling of color and of skullcap of various ecclesiastical garbs and gowns in the work of our center city, in slum clearance and educational renewal, and voter registration in the South, and concerns for peace, the marches in our public squares in Washington, is evidence of the effectiveness of this mood. It augurs well for a better citizenship. There's no dimension of religious toleration, of determined amiability, has helped all of us to see beyond the surface. Once upon a time, not so very long ago, when we studied comparative religions, we had described for us the rites and ceremonies of other faiths, and because they were other, they seemed quaint and bizarre, if not somewhat outlandish. And we had listed for us the dogmas and the doctrines, the affirmations of other faiths, and because they were others, they seemed implausible and passing strange. Well, this new mood has forced all of us to look beneath the surface, to seek the historical and the geographic and the cultural factors which made this particular denomination or that express their search for God and for meaning in a particular term or through a particular symbol and rite. We've asked why and wherefore. We have found, not to our amazement, we have found that there are many avenues to a deep and spiritually meaningful life. The temperature of religious competitiveness has dropped a bit, though there is still a great deal of inter-religious competition among us. But as the temperature of religious competition has dropped, as men have begun to realize the dignity and the worthwhileness of other persuasions and of other commitments, other men, less concerned with faith, the indifferent, have been moved to ask these questions. Are the great religions of the West interchangeable? Have we perhaps come to that point in time when we ought to do away with all the apparatus and the institutions of the traditional religions and create a new spiritual consensus which would not have the barriers which now exist between men? In an age where it is more important to believe than to believe a specific dogma or a specific doctrine, it's perhaps understandable that men are searching for the common beliefs, the least common denominator of belief, that the men are asking the questions I have indicated. Indeed, as I listen to religious discussion today, I find symbolic of it that advertisement which appears now and again in our press. You see a dome and a spire, Star of David, a cross, a church and a synagogue, and a couple about to enter with their children through obviously ecclesiastical portals. And above it all is the legend, it doesn't matter where you worship, just be sure that you worship this weekend. When I see this advertisement or one like it, I'm often reminded of that wonderful folk tale which is told of the kindly and wise sage who was a bit overly generous in his spirit. Perhaps you know it. The scholar was seated in his study, surrounded by his books, when all of a sudden the door blew open and a whirlwind of a woman came into the room, pouring out as she came a litany of complaint against her husband. He abused her, he misused her, he was violent and cruel to her. The sage listened quietly, nodded comfortingly. Whenever she paused for a breath, he would murmur, "You're right, my dear, you're right." Calmed, purged, released of her tension, the woman went home. But she had hardly enough time at home to tell her husband that the rabbi had approved her complaint in her case, when all of a sudden this worthy burst through the door, and before he could be asked to be seated, told a long, sad, and brutal story of bitterness and silence and slovenliness and abuse. And again the sage listened patiently. Again he nodded comfortingly. And again, whenever there was a pause, the point having been made, breath to be gotten, he would murmur, "You're right. You're right." Mollified, the husband left. But he left behind him a very puzzled and bewildered secretary who had heard both of these stories and who now turned to his master and said, "My teacher, the husband and the wife told conflicting stories. They couldn't possibly both be right." And the answer came, "You're right too, my son. You're right, you're right, and you're right too." In an age which sees the virtue of belief and is not overly concerned with the substance and the content of belief, it is easy to be agreeable. It is easy to be amiable. But it is difficult to understand the meaning of the second commandment which says to us quite clearly, beware, you may be wrong, and he may be wrong. Indeed, the whole consensus of your age may be wrongly founded. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, nor any manner of likeness, of anything that is in the heavens above, or the earth beneath, or the waters under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down to them, nor serve them. Now this second commandment, which casts this parochial, rather narrow shadow upon us, is but the most significant of the many laws in the Bible which deliberately set out to separate the Jew from the heathen world, or rather, to separate the Jew from heathen religious practice and custom. A Hebrew might not build for himself an altar if it was suspect that this altar could be used for heathen sacrifice. And if he found an altar built for heathen sacrifice, he must pull it down stone by stone and plow the place under. He could not buy for himself a statuette, which might once have been worshipped as an idol or an icon. And he could not fashion himself, if he were talented as a sculptor, an icon or an idol which might be used in heathen worship. If he came across the sacred groves of the Canaanites, the terebinths, he was to cut these down and burn up the trees for common fuel. Any act which was associated with a religious worship was proscribed to him. He could not consult necromancers nor oracles. He could not pile little stone upon little stone as the ancients did when they offered their petition. He could not embalm his dead, for this was a way of adoration to the gods of death among the Egyptians. Avodah Zarah, all that was foreign to the worship of God, all that was practiced in the worship of any other god, was forbidden on pain of death to the Hebrew. Now, why so? Why was the religious spirit of the Jew determined to separate out our ancestors from the easy accommodation, from the rationalizations of tolerance, which were so common in the heathen world about them? Some would answer that the reason lies in a narrow ethnic parochialism, that we were chauvinists and nationalists, and that this segregationist theology is merely a reflex of a segregationist sociology, that believing in ourselves to be a chosen people, we believed we had a choice, unique form of worship which must be kept pristine, which cannot be mingled with any other form of worship, lest it be debased. Now, this is sheer nonsense, claptrap. For however much our fathers were concerned with the quality, the purity of the worship of the one God, they were equally concerned with the dignity of every man, with the fundamental concept of humanity and brotherhood. All men, are created in the image of God, not just the Hebrew. Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us all? There shall be one law for the homeborn and for the stranger that is within thy gates. Indeed, it was not the Hebrew prophet, but the heathen philosopher who built high the walls, the bars between royalty and commonality, between citizen and alien, between Greek and barbarian, between free man and slave. Jewish law, Jewish philosophy, Jewish interest knew none of these distinctions. All men were created in the image of God. Why then did our fathers deny to the Jew the easy justification that there is good in every cult, that it could not make a great deal of difference if we took a rite here and a colorful ceremony there, or brought an icon into the sanctuary here? The answer, I believe, lies in an astute observation that outrageous beliefs lead to outrageous acts. I read to you this morning from the 12th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. You may recall the concluding verse of that chapter. For you shall not do unto the Lord thy God according to all the abominations which they do unto their gods. For these are the abominations which the Lord thy God hateth. Even so do they cause their sons and their daughters to be burnt unto their gods. It made in the ancient world a great deal of difference whether you worship the All-Merciful, the One, or whether you worship the great fire god Moloch. And time and again at your holy seasons, sacrificed sadistically a child, making him walk a bed of hot coals and fire into the devouring maw of the underworld, to Moloch. Makes a great difference whether you worship the god of violence and of fire and of destruction, or whether you worship the El Rachum V'Chanun, the one God, the merciful and gracious God, whose only proper sacrifice is a humble and a contrite heart. Idolatry glorifies a part of the miracle of life, a part and not the whole. And whenever a virtue is taken to excess, whenever it is not seen in balance with all the other responsibilities of life, it becomes a vice, vulgar and excessive. And lacking the balanced view, lacking a unitary view of the world, of the oneness of God and the oneness of man, and the oneness of moral responsibility, the oneness of love, the oneness of wisdom, the oneness of concern, idolatry was, by its very definition, given to excess, to vulgarity. Love is a virtue. Love is a blessing. The love of which becomes a worship becomes lust. The love goddess worship becomes a Dionysiac rite. Wisdom is a virtue. Wisdom is a blessing. But wisdom worshipped as a supreme goddess of the pantheon becomes a justification for an intellectual arrogance, for the undermining of democracy, for the assumption that there are tyrants who know best. And it was these tyrants who destroyed the democracy of the Greek city-states. All of us depend ultimately on fertility and the fecundity of the earth on the harvest season. We praise our God, Shechayanu v'kiyamanu v'giyanu, Lazman Hazeh, who has kept us alive and who sustains us, on whose bounty we depend to remain alive. It's one of the elemental relationships of life. But to worship a goddess of fertility, to worship fecundity, to make this the sole devotion of your cult, is inevitably to create a practice of mimetic rites which conscripts young people as temple prostitutes. Presumably the mingling of their seed encourages and stimulates the mingling of the seed in the good earth. Idolatry lacked balance. Every idol was only a part, stood for only a part of the great miracle which is being. And lacking balance, its worship inevitably became gross and excessive. It was only with our ancestors, with the worship of the one God, that worship became calm, a matter of moral challenge, a place for moral instruction, for quiet meditation, for the singing of gentle hymns, and the raising to God of heartfelt and thoughtful prayer. It was only with the worship of the one God that men were able to create a ceremony, a ritual, which could grace every spiritual seasons of a man's life, speak to him of all the many confusions which surround him, offer him instruction out of this confusion, grace his life with dignity, create that form of worship which is now the common inheritance of all mankind. We return to the second commandment. The second commandment speaks of idolatry. The Jews came to the second commandment out of the astute observation that outrageous beliefs lead to outrageous acts. But it seems a matter of ordinary observation that the great religions of the West are not outrageous in their belief. All of the great religions of our world, of our Western world, depend upon the fundamental affirmations of our Bible. They are monotheistic. I am the Lord thy God. I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. As I created freedom for you, go now and create freedom and opportunity and justice for all mankind. And so it was that 1700 years ago, with the rise of Christianity, and somewhat later with the rise of Islam, our rabbis were careful to insist that the laws of idolatry no longer regulate the relationship between Jew and Christian, between Jew and Muslim. These are fellow monotheists. We are encouraged to meet, to exchange ideas, to visit each other's holy places, to take part with one another in common national holiday observances. He who has given up idolatry, the Talmud said, is as if he were a Jew. We come then to our question. Given the religions of the West, given the religions of the 20th century, does it make any real difference at which altar we worship? And the answer must be both yes and no. From the point of view of salvation, it makes very little difference. No religion can claim any longer that it controls the key to the kingdom. There are many ladders to heaven, there are many gates in heaven, and there are many keys that fit that gate. But from the point of view of stimulation, of encouragement, from the perspective of the loftiness of a faced vision, from the perspectiveness of the surging thrust, the dynamism of its moral teaching, there are differences between the religions of our world. Let me speak of salvation and of truth. Let me speak of confidence and of arrogance. Confidence has built civilization. Confidence become arrogance has destroyed civilization and threatens now to destroy all civilization. Confident men set out to discover what they could of the world in which we live. Arrogant men set out to take their little scraps of knowledge, to claim them as the deposit of truth, to sanctify them and to assert that he who does not agree that this is the truth, the whole truth, the final truth, is an error, misguided, heretic, to be burnt at the stake, to be driven out beyond the pale. The truth belongs to God alone. All that man knows of the truth is an occasional glimpse, a shimmer of light, grasped by a man of genius, grasped by someone of understanding. Every religion is by definition incomplete, and indeed that is as it should be. For faith is not a statement of truth, but a search. Faith is a search for the nature of being. Faith is a search for the meaning of my being. Faith is a search for the direction in which my life must be led. Democritus said this years ago when he observed that truth has been placed in the nethermost and deepest parts of the sea. All that we see of truth is a shimmer of some bright presence down deep below, seen through the undulation and the opaqueness of the waves. Job went even further. The poet asks rhetorically, where is truth to be found? The deep saith, it is not in me. The seas say, it is not in me. Whence then is the place of truth? Truth is hidden from the eyes of all the living. Truth is beyond the comprehension of all creatures. No man controls truth. All that we know is the tiniest bit, a morsel, a scrap of the total and wholeness of the meaning of life. God's ways are not our ways, and his thoughts are not our thoughts. Just as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are his ways higher than our ways, and his thoughts than our thoughts. Religions must be humble when they claim the teaching, the truth. But are there no differences between the religions of the West? Of course there are. There are religions which are simple, not teaching arts, but healing arts. There are religions which are based on credulity, fear, a mystery, a nonsense. There are religions which have ceased teaching and seek only to preserve their prerogatives. There are religions which have ceased preaching and seek only to make their peace with the status quo. It is not so much any longer that there is a great difference at the base in the vision of the three monotheistic faiths of our world, but rather within those faiths. There are shrines and sanctuaries and holy places where God is truly worshipped, and there are shrines and sanctuaries and holy places when, above all, a false image of God is projected and worshipped in the name of God. 3,000 and more years before Dr. Freud, our ancestors understood the psychology of projection, how a privileged class will, almost without knowing it, project unto God the teachings of obedience and submission, make the burden of the teaching the observance of law and order, and how an underprivileged class will project upon God the teachings, the needs, the passions, the violence, which are kept otherwise suppressed within. And so it is with us. In America today, religion is monotheistic. How much of our life is pagan? There is not a shrine in America today which does not have the label, "This is the house of God, the one God, the only God." But in how many of those holy places is God a white man? And in how many of those holy places is God a black man? There is not a place in the United States which does not have above its doors, the Lord is one. But in how many of these pulpits and discussions and classrooms and rituals is it assumed that God prefers Americans to Russians? That God carries the banner of our armies in their relentless battles? There is not a sanctuary in this country in which it is not taught that God, Lord, love thy neighbor as thyself. But in how many sanctuaries and holy places is it told that God consecrates the marketplace, bitterness and competition between men? The holy places of the ancients had a sanctum sanctorum, a most sacred room, in which the idol or the sacred image were kept. The temple in Jerusalem had a sanctum sanctorum, a special room. It was called the Devir, the Holy of Holies. And in that place, there was nothing, emptiness, only a sense of the presence of God. For it lies at the heart of our worship. God is not here, but everywhere. God's concerns are not only with me, but with all men. God not only loves this people, Israel, but all mankind. O Lord, where shall I find thee? High and hidden is thy place, and where shall I not find thee? Whose glory fills all space. What then does the second commandment teach us today? But there is a worship which is proper, and there is a worship which is improper and valueless. And that worship which is proper is the worship of the oneness, of the totality, of the unity of God, of the oneness, of the unity of mankind, of the oneness and of the unity of the moral law. That any church, any synagogue, any mosque, which fails to understand the interrelationship of all mankind, the interrelationship of all moral command, the interrelationship of all human duty and responsibility, fails to worship the one God. The prophet Ezekiel said it, Anashim ha'ele, he'elu alibam ekilu lehem. These people, you and I, now and again take our false gods, our needs, our ambitions, our prejudices into our hearts and sanctify them. And so the second commandment tells us today, seek to purge your heart of the false god. Seek to understand how you have where you have created God in your own image, in what measure he is yours, in what measure he is his own, in what measure you have made him consecrate your ideology, your private prejudice, and in what measure you serve his ideology, his first principles, his decisions for man. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, nor any manner of likeness of anything that is in the heavens above, or the earth beneath, or the waters under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down to them, nor serve them. Amen.